given permission, either implicitly or explicitly. Given Tosh's general history of immature, frattish humor, I wasn't surprised when he made inappropriate statements about rape humor during a set at the Laugh Factory. Rape jokes are part of his shtick. During that set, a young woman in the audience yelled, "Actually, rape jokes are never funny." Tosh maturely responded, "Wouldn't it be funny if that girl got raped by like 5 guys right now? Like right now? What if a bunch of guys just raped her? What if indeed?" There's no better follow-up for a rape joke than a gang rape joke, because if rape is funny, gang rape is funnier. Rape humor is designed to remind women that they are still not quite equal. Just as their bodies and reproductive freedom are open to legislation and public discourse, so are their other issues. When women respond negatively to misogynistic or rape humor, they are sensitive and branded as feminist, a word that has, as of late, become a catch-all term for woman who does not tolerate bullshit. Perhaps rape jokes are funny, but I cannot fathom how. Humor is subjective, but is it that subjective? I don't have it in me to find rape jokes funny, or to tolerate them in any way. It's too close a topic. Rape is many things: humiliating, degrading, physically and emotionally painful, exhausting, irritating, and sometimes it is even banal. It is rarely funny for most women. There are not enough years in this lifetime to create the kind of distance where I could laugh and say, "That one time when I was gang raped was totally hilarious, a real laugh riot." Somewhere along the line, we started misinterpreting the First Amendment and this idea of the freedom of speech the amendment grants us. We are free to speak as we choose without fear of prosecution or persecution, but we are not free to speak as we choose without consequence. The woman who called Tosh out on his comments walked out of the club, and a friend posted about it on Tumblr. The internet picked up her story. Tosh has since offered a small act of contrition, qualified by his assertion that his comments were shared out of context. He was heckled. He clearly doesn't think he has done anything wrong. His half-assed apology is the kind where he is merely sorry someone has taken offense rather than taking responsibility for his actions. He will never think it is wrong to joke about rape. Like I said, it takes all kinds. Many comedians are very proud of themselves for saying the things others are supposedly afraid to say. They are at the forefront of this culture of entitlement where we get to do anything, think anything, and say anything. Those who refrain from using humor to comment on the awful things in the world don't abstain because they are afraid. Maybe, just maybe, they have common sense. They have conscience. Sometimes saying what others are afraid or unwilling to say is just being an asshole. We are all free to be assholes, but we are not free to do so without consequence. What Tosh calls heckling, I'd call taking a stand. All too often when we see injustices, both great and small, we think, "That's terrible," but we do nothing. We say nothing. We let other people fight their own battles. We remain silent because silence is easier. Qui tace consentire videtur is Latin for silence gives consent. When we say nothing, when we do nothing, we are consenting to these trespasses against us. When that woman stood up and said, "No, rape is not funny," she did not consent to participating in a culture that encourages lax attitudes towards sexual violence and the concerns of women. Rape humor is what encourages a man to feel comfortable tweeting to Daniel Tosh, "The only PPL who are mad at you are the feminist bitches who never get laid and hope they get raped so they can get laid," which is one of the idiotic Pavlovian responses a certain kind of person has when women have the nerve to suggest that they don't find sexual violence amusing. In that man's universe, women who get properly laid are totally fine with rape humor. A satisfied vagina is a balm in Gilead. We know the appalling statistics. We know sexual violence is embedded within our culture so deeply that there exists a website, Holla Back, where women regularly report street harassment. Sexual violence is so problematic that there is a Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and there are countless organizations whose sole function is to support victims of sexual violence. We live in a society where the phrase rape culture exists because the culture itself exists. This climate is staggering. Either you recognize that or you don't. Rape humor is not just jokes or stand-up. Humor about sexual violence suggests permissiveness, not for people who would never commit such acts, but for the people who have whatever weakness allows them to do terrible things unto others. If any number of young men were willing to film themselves touching women lightly on their stomachs, how many were encouraged to ignore a woman's no because Daniel Tosh finds rape amusing? What are the consequences if the answer is even one? What surprises me, what really troubles me is this. Only one person stood up and had the strength of conviction to say, enough. Dear young ladies who love Chris Brown so much, they would let him beat them. Do you know what you're saying? Do you really? You may think you're joking. I want to believe you're joking because, a man putting his hands on you is so funny in the reality from where you are communicating. Clearly, we have different definitions of funny. But perhaps you truly do find it amusing to joke about domestic violence. I am not here to judge you. I'm afraid you're not joking. I'm afraid you are quite serious. You are saying you are willing to be abused. You are willing to sacrifice your dignity. For what? You are impressed by some combination of a young man's music, charisma, dancing ability, and or good looks? That is understandable. Everybody's got his or her something. However, you are also saying that suffering Chris Brown's abuse would be a fair exchange for his attention. However fleeting, you must realize that attention would be. When you look past the image, a celebrity is merely a person you know nothing about. You are willing to be abused for the mirage of fame in the desert of your life. For people who enjoy BDSM, there's this thing called consent, which should always exist in human interactions, but which is exceedingly important when you entrust your body and mind to someone else in such ways. You can say, "I want you to hurt me," or "I want you to humiliate me," or "I want you to dominate me," and someone else will do so. But, and this is important, when you say in some form or fashion, "stop," the pain or humiliation or domination stops. No questions asked. That is a powerful, perfect moment. There is nothing better than knowing the suffering can stop, than knowing you must endure, but if you no longer wish to do so, you don't have to, because it is safe to withdraw your consent. There is nothing better than knowing you have some control in a situation that feels so far beyond your control. When you tell a man like Chris Brown, at least the man he has shown himself to be, to stop. He won't. With abuse, there is no stopping. There is no consent. You will never have any control. You will never know how good it feels to endure by your choice, because that choice does not belong to you and never will. Do you see that distinction? I don't know Chris Brown. I have never met him and probably never will. I know his music. Sometimes it's catchy. Mostly, to my ears, it's contrived and overproduced. I've seen him dance. He can work with choreography. He is reasonably attractive. I don't really get it, to be honest, but I don't need to get it. You likely wouldn't understand whom I find attractive either. What I do understand is that Chris Brown means something to you, that he arouses you physically or emotionally. He arouses you to such an extent you are willing to do whatever it takes to be within his incandescent sphere, for even a little while. Did you read the police report from the infamous incident where Chris Brown beat his then-girlfriend, Rihanna? The details are disturbing and graphic and leave the distinct impression that what took place on that night in 2009 was perhaps not an isolated incident. If you were to get with Chris Brown, there's a good chance you would regret it. Because time and again, he has shown he cannot control his rage. He would hardly be concerned with you at all. This is the man he has shown himself to be. I am sorry our culture has treated women so poorly for so long that suffering abuse to receive celebrity attention seems like a fair and reasonable trade. We have failed you. Utterly. We failed you when Chris Brown received a slap on the wrist for his crime and was subsequently allowed to perform at the 2012 Grammys, not once, but twice. We failed you when he was awarded Best R&B Album at that same ceremony. This is not to say he has no right to move on from his crime, but he has demonstrated not one ounce of contrition. Instead, he has flagrantly reveled in his bad boy persona and taunted the public at every turn. He's young and troubled, but that's an explanation for his behavior, not an excuse. We failed you when Charlie Sheen was allowed and eagerly encouraged to continue to star in movies and have a hit television show that basically printed him money after he shot Kelly Preston accidentally. And he allegedly hit a UCLA student in the head when she wouldn't have sex with him. And he threatened to kill his ex-wife, Denise Richards. And he held a knife to his ex-wife, Brooke Mueller's throat. We failed you when Roman Polanski received an Oscar, even though he was accused of committing a crime so terrible he hasn't been able to return to the United States for more than 30 years. We failed you when Sean Penn fought violently with Madonna and continued a successful, critically acclaimed career and also received an Oscar. We fail you every single time a famous man treats a woman badly without legal, professional, or personal consequence. Over and over again, we tell you it is acceptable for men, famous, infamous, or not at all famous, to abuse women. We look the other way. We make excuses. We reward these men for their bad behavior. We tell you that, as a young woman, you have little value or place in this society. Clearly, we have sent these messages with such alarming regularity and consistency, we have encouraged you to willingly run toward something violent and terrible with your eyes and arms wide open. I am sorry. I'm not shocked by your willingness to suffer without the right to consent. We are all susceptible to the charisma of people who behave badly, myself included. I am painfully reminded of how bad a feminist I am when I consider someone like Richard Pryor. He was a comic genius. I am always floored by how he tackled the complexities of race with his humor. Pryor was also flagrantly abusive toward the women he loved. His brilliance cannot be overlooked. That's what I tell myself. But then I imagine all the hurt he caused, and how rarely that hurt is discussed. That may be the saddest thing of all. Blurred Lines, Indeed. In his single, Blurred Lines, Robin Thicke sings soulfully about giving a good girl what she really wants. Buck wild sex, even if she can't come out and admit it. It's a catchy enough song. Some might even call it the anthem of summer 2013. But Blurred Lines is also a song that revisits the age-old belief that sometimes when a woman says no, she really means yes. Critics have been vocal about the sexual violence undertones in the song, and they're not wrong. Robin just knows you want it, girl. He just does, so shut up and let him give it to you. Scores of men and women are apparently on board. Blurred Lines is Thicke's most popular song to date. In his single Give It To You, Thicke doubles down on his bad boy phase with lyrics that tell a woman what he has for her, including a reference to his endowment. In the wake of the criticism, Thicke is fairly unapologetic, saying, "Women and their bodies are beautiful. Men are always going to want to follow them around." I guess that's that. Men want what they want. As much as it pains me to admit, I like these songs. They make me want to dance. I want to sing along. They are delightful pop confections. But I enjoy the songs the way I have to enjoy most music. I have to forget I am a sentient being. I have to lighten up. Take Kanye West's Yeezus. The album is compelling and ambitious, with sounds that are aggressive, if not hostile. When Yeezus was released, I listened to the album on repeat. I wanted to love Yeezus, but I can't because of lyrics like, "You see, it's leaders and it's followers, but I'd rather be a dick than a swallower." From the song New Slaves. Kanye's disdain for women overwhelms nearly every track. But then there's a song like Blood on the Leaves that is so outstanding, you can't possibly dismiss the album entirely. We are constantly faced by this uncomfortable balance between brilliance and bad behavior. This is just music, right? These artists are merely expressing themselves. As a writer, I recognize the necessity of creative freedom. I have finally heard a couple of funny rape jokes. Ever Maynard's joke about the fear instilled in women and the assumption of the inevitability of rape, and Wanda Sykes' joke about wanting a detachable vagina to better avoid rape while out and about. I still hate rape jokes, but I hate censorship more. I hate that I have to choose. Ken Hoinsky is a pickup artist who ran a successful Kickstarter fundraising campaign for his book Above the Game, where he doles out his wisdom to help men who might be shy or awkward around the ladies. When a critical mass of people became aware of Hoinsky's project, there was outcry because some of Hoinsky's advice, well, it's questionable. It blurs lines. Still, Kickstarter didn't cancel the project. Later, the company apologized. Moving forward, it promised not to allow the creators of seduction guides to use the Kickstarter platform. Additionally, Kickstarter made a significant financial contribution to RAIN. Hoinsky will publish his book and join a small legion of pickup artists who treat women as conquests rather than human beings, who believe that when a woman says no, she's really saying maybe. Men want what they want. So much of our culture caters to giving men what they want. A high school student invites model Kate Upton to attend his prom, and he's congratulated for his audacity. A male fan at a Beyoncé concert reaches up to the stage to slap her ass because her ass is there, her ass is magnificent, and he wants to feel it. The science fiction fandom community is often embroiled in heated discussions across the internet about the ongoing problem of sexual harassment at conventions. Countless women are telling all manner of stories about how, without their consent, they are groped, ogled, lured into hotel rooms under false pretenses, physically lifted off the ground, and more. But men want what they want. We should all lighten up. It's hard not to feel humorless as a woman and a feminist, to recognize misogyny in so many forms, some great and some small, and know you're not imagining things. It's hard to be told to lighten up, because if you lighten up anymore, you're going to float the fuck away. The problem is not that one of these things is happening, it's that they are all happening, concurrently and constantly. These are just songs. They're just jokes. It's just a hug. They're just breasts. Smile. You're beautiful. Can a man pay you a compliment? In truth, this is all a symptom of a much more virulent cultural sickness. One where women exist to satisfy the whims of men. One where a woman's worth is consistently diminished or entirely ignored. Or I could put it this way. Let's say this is simply the world we live in. If there is a spectrum of misogyny with pop culture on one end and the disrespect for women's boundaries in the middle, on the other end we have our nation's lawmakers who implicitly encourage this entire spectrum to thrive. In 2013, state legislators in Texas, Ohio, and North Carolina, among others, trampled all over reproductive freedom, trying to limit when a woman can have an abortion and where abortions can be provided, as well as redefining what a fetus is. A culture that treats women as objects, that gleefully supports entertainment that is more often demeaning toward women than it is not, that encourages the erosion of a woman's autonomy and personal space, is the same culture that elects state lawmakers who work tirelessly to enact restrictive abortion legislation. Or is it that state lawmakers who work tirelessly to enact restrictive abortion legislation encourage their constituents to treat women as objects? Perhaps this is trickle-down misogyny. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? On June 30th, 2013, in the Room for Debate section, The New York Times asked, would support for abortion rights grow if more women discussed their abortions? When I first saw the question, I bristled. Women shouldn't have to sacrifice their personal histories to enlighten those who are probably uninterested in enlightenment. At some point, the greater good isn't enough of a justification for such sacrifice. Here's a woman's story. Who she is doesn't matter. She could be any woman, a friend, a sister, a mother, an aunt. Say she becomes pregnant. Say the pregnancy is unplanned, but she's financially and emotionally stable enough that she and her boyfriend decide, let's do this. Say she's pro-choice, but from the moment she realizes she's pregnant, it feels like she's carrying a baby. Still, she is staunchly pro-choice, always will be. Say if she didn't think she and her boyfriend could give the baby a good life, she would have an abortion. Say she's in the kitchen during her 27th week when she falls to her knees because there is a terrible cramping in her abdomen. Say she starts bleeding and it won't stop. Say she and her boyfriend rush to the hospital. Say she loses consciousness. Say when she wakes up, the baby is gone, because it came down to her life or the baby's. Say she spends years feeling like the wrong choice was made. This is a story about reproductive freedom. This is a story about a woman's life and the value of her life. Choices were made. Choices were taken away. Say this woman lived in a state where certain choices were sacrificed in favor of the sanctity of life. Say she died, and so much for sanctity. Who would tell her story then? And what if she doesn't want to tell her story? What if it's too personal, too painful? What do these confessions really do? Some people will be moved, but those are rarely the same people who support legislation to erode reproductive freedom. Immovable people will not be moved by testimony. Her story becomes an emotional spectacle, something for people to consider briefly before moving on to the next sad story. There is no shortage of sad stories when it comes to women and their reproductive lives. Robin Thicke sings about what he knows a woman wants. Fine. Daniel Tosh encourages his fans to touch women lightly on the stomach and film themselves doing so. Fine. Ken Hoinsky believes persistence is a virtue. Fine. Texas Governor Rick Perry says of Senator Wendy Davis, she was the daughter of a single woman. She was a teenage mother herself. She managed to eventually graduate from Harvard Law School and serve in the Texas Senate. It's just unfortunate that she hasn't learned from her own example that every life must be given a chance to realize its full potential and that every life matters. Fine. In Ohio, any woman seeking an abortion must get an ultrasound. If she has complications from an abortion, she must go to a private rather than public hospital. The state legislators pushing the various initiatives across the country are just looking out for women. Fine, fine, fine. Men want to protect women. Unless, of course, they want to grab those women's asses. Lighten up. Men want what they want. Sometimes they make their desires plain with music to which I can't help but sing along. Blurred lines, indeed. The Trouble with Prince Charming, or He Who Trespassed Against Us. We all know the common fairy tale. There's a man and a woman, needless to say. We rarely see stories about a woman and a woman, or a man and a man, who must overcome some obstacle to reach happily ever after. There is always a happily ever after. I enjoy fairy tales because I need to believe, despite my cynicism, that there is a happy ending for everyone, especially me. The older I get, though, the more I realize how fairy tales demand a great deal from the woman. The man in most fairy tales, Prince Charming, in all his iterations, really isn't that interesting. In most fairy tales, he is blandly attractive and rarely seems to demonstrate much personality, taste, or intelligence. We're supposed to believe that this is totally fine because he is Prince Charming. His charm is supposedly enough. The Disney versions of fairy tales, the ones with which we are probably most familiar, don't offer much in the way of Prince Charming. In The Little Mermaid, Prince Eric has a great woman right in front of him, but is so obsessed with this pretty voice he once heard, he can't appreciate what he has. In Snow White, the prince doesn't even find Snow White until she is comatose. And he is so lacking in imagination, he simply falls in love with her seemingly lifeless body. In Beauty and the Beast, Belle is given away by her father to the Beast himself, and then must endure the attentions of a man who essentially views her as chattel. Only through sacrificing herself and loving a beast of a man can she finally learn that he is, in fact, a handsome prince. The thing about fairy tales is that the princess finds her prince, but there's usually a price to pay. A compromise is required for happily ever after. The woman in the fairy tale is generally the one who pays the price. This seems to be the nature of sacrifice. Consider the Twilight series. The four books are about vampires and werewolves and the sweeping love story between Bella, a young girl, and Edward, an old vampire. Really, though, the Twilight series is a new kind of fairy tale. Is there anything particularly compelling about Edward Cullen? He sparkles. He's theoretically attractive, but seems to have only one interest, loving Bella and controlling every decision she makes. We're supposed to believe his obsessive control and devotion are somehow appealing. We're supposed to believe he is Prince Charming, albeit flawed, because he needs to drink blood to survive. Accepting Edward's controlling obsession and vampirism is the compromise required of Bella. Eventually, becoming a vampire, becoming undead, is the price Bella must pay for her happily ever after. We're supposed to believe she's fine with that because Bella is the one who advocates so fiercely for Edward to turn her into a vampire. We're supposed to believe Edward is worth that sacrifice. 50 Shades of Grey, 50 Shades Darker, and 50 Shades Freed by E.L. James together compose a modern fairy tale with a dark, erotic twist. The trilogy began as fan fiction. Fiction written by fans of an original series without actually being a part of it, inspired by Twilight. While grounded in the fairy tale tradition and rising out of fan fiction, 50 Shades is also the first series that could be categorized as erotica and that has been embraced by the mainstream. If you forget, of course, Anne Rice's Sleeping Beauty trilogy. Fan fiction and erotica are not new, but there is something about the 50 Shades trilogy that has piqued the popular imagination. The books are erotic, amusing in their absurdity, and disturbing in their cultural implications about just how much trouble Prince Charming can be. In 50 Shades of Grey, a bright young college student, Anastasia Steele, is forced to take the place of her student reporter best friend, Kate, who has fallen ill. Anastasia, or Anna, travels to Seattle to interview Christian Grey, a handsome, reclusive, and enigmatic billionaire, for the student paper. During their initial meeting, Anna stammers her way through an uncomfortable interview, distracted by Christian's extraordinary good looks, of course. He encourages Anna to work for him. They banter. True love is born. But there is a catch. There has to be a catch, an obstacle. This is the way of fairy tales. Over 3 books, Anna and Christian try to have a relationship, but they are impeded by Christian's abiding interest in BDSM, or at least E.L. James's fantasy version of BDSM. His unwillingness to engage in a normal relationship and Anna's desire for a normal relationship. There is all kinds of drama, and with each book, that drama becomes increasingly absurd, but strangely addictive. A crazy former submissive. An older former lover and mistress who earns the nickname Mrs. Robinson. A sexually harassing boss with a chip on his shoulder. Family drama. Helicopter crashes. Arson. Oh my! When she meets Christian, Anna is, conveniently, a 21-year-old virgin who has never even masturbated. Of course. Christian gets to show Anna the ropes, so to speak, in a very dramatic scene where he grabs her by the wrist and leads her to his bedroom to properly deflower her. The kinkiness can wait, but her vagina cannot. As he sweeps Anna off her feet, Christian says, "We're going to rectify the situation right now," which is surely what every woman wants to hear when she has sex for the first time. In a never-ending scene, Christian makes their first lovemaking encounter all about Anna. He makes her come by stimulating her nipples. They fool around some more, and finally, Christian can no longer control himself. He takes off his boxers and tears open a condom wrapper while Anna stares at his enormous cock, bewildered that she is so innocent and pure. Of course. Christian says, "Don't worry. You expand, too." You haven't lived until you've read such prose. Before long, Christian rips through Anna's virginity. They both come, and her virginity situation is indeed rectified, pleasantly for all involved. The books quickly devolve into passionate-ish sex scenes, interrupted by arguments about their different desires. Christian's recalcitrance toward normalcy and the ridiculous drama both within the relationship and beyond. Whenever women do something in significant numbers, the media immediately becomes frenzied as they try to understand this new mystery of womanhood. If that something involves female desire, as if female desire is entirely uniform, the frenzy takes on a sharper pitch. Nearly every major publication has offered at least one think piece about the 50 Shades series. The books have been labeled with the condescending term mommy porn because the trilogy has found a great deal of success among a certain demographic. Once that happens, we have to call it a trend. And then we need to write trend pieces that exhaustively analyze something that probably isn't very worthy of analysis. Is it really newsworthy that a number of women have finally found something that turns them on? Or is the response to 50 Shades a depressing commentary on the state of modern desire? A great deal of the conversation about these books focuses on the erotic elements. There is so much explicit, highly implausible sex to be found in 50 Shades, and it always ends in the most amazing orgasms ever. Anna and Christian have sex on an airplane and in an elevator and in a car. They have sex in several different beds, and they have sex in Christian's playroom, which Anna calls the Red Room of Pain, a dungeon so outlandishly equipped that when she first sees it, Anna thinks, "It feels like I've time-traveled back to the 16th century and the Spanish Inquisition." Inside, she finds deep burgundy walls, a large wooden cross, an iron grid hanging from the ceiling, lots of ropes and chains and paddles and whips and crops and other toys, as if real BDSM is manifested solely in the extravagant display of toys. This analogy might help illustrate the difference between BDSM in the real world and BDSM in the world of E.L. James. 50 Shades BDSM. McDonald's food. I understand why these books are so popular, beyond the underlying fairy tale. There are hot moments. Chances are you will be turned on by something in these books. The trilogy tries valiantly to make the reader believe female pleasure is the most important part of a sexual experience, despite Christian Grey's dominant proclivities. In nearly all the sex scenes, Christian is meticulous about pleasuring Anna. He lavishes her body with all manner of sexual attention. The books are generous in detailing lady orgasms that make it clear Christian Grey is the best lover ever. It's a nice little fantasy. When you look deeper, though, which is challenging in a trilogy with the depth of a murky wading pool, these books are really about Anna trying to change slash save Christian from his demons. She is the virginal good girl who can lead the dark bad boy to salvation. As if, historically, trying to change a man has ever worked out well. At one point during their courtship, Anna thinks, "This man, whom I once thought of as a romantic hero, a brave shining white knight, or the dark knight, as he said, he's not a hero. He's a man with serious, deep emotional flaws. And he's dragging me into the dark. Can I not guide him into the light? I wanted to take Anna aside and say, Girl, you cannot lead this man into the light. Let that dream go. After all the trials this couple faces, and after all the hot sex, we're supposed to think this trilogy is about a young woman and her happily ever after. It's not. Anna's sexual awakening is a convenient vehicle for the awakening of Christian's humanity. 50 Shades is about a man finding peace and happiness because he finally finds a woman willing to tolerate his bullshit for long enough. 50 Shades is engaging in that simplistic, formulaic manner of romance novels or fairy tales. But the books are terribly written in really delightful ways. I embraced the absurdity with open arms and laughed and laughed. Anna has no gag reflex, which is so very convenient. On those rare occasions she goes down on Christian, Anna has no problem orally accommodating Christian's girth. She even swallows, so she's obviously a keeper. Christian is one of those chatty lovers who, throughout all three books, spends a great deal of time narrating what he is doing, wants to do, and or will do to Anna, adding at least an extra 10,000 words to each book. In one of the books, Anna asks for a glass of white Pinot Grigio. Whenever I reconsider that phrase, I die laughing because it is the laziest mistake possible. There is product placement by Audi. Christian drives an Audi, gives his favorite submissives Audis. He gives Anna, over the course of their relationship, 2 Audis. His generosity truly knows no bounds. Christian gives Anna expensive clothes, La Perla lingerie, a MacBook, an iPad, a BlackBerry, expensive rare books, a honeymoon on a yacht, and on and on. If you have a materialistic fantasy, this book will curb that edge. Swaths of the story are told via reproduced email exchanges. That is, we literally see the emails Anna and Christian exchange, with all the annoying banter you might expect from a couple falling in love, and much more. These emails alone are worth the price of admission. In the first book, when Christian is trying to introduce Anna to his lifestyle, James reproduces Christian's dominant-slash-submissive contract 3 or 4 times, as if we couldn't get the gist the first time. The contract is clearly something James found hanging around the internet. It dictates all manner of supposedly submissive behaviors, including personal grooming, sleep hygiene, wardrobe, diet, comportment, and sexual activity. An exhaustive amount of the first book is given over to Anna and Christian negotiating this contract, what they each will or won't do. Only Anna never signs the contract, so mostly this is a device to repeatedly show us how different the lovers are. Anna says or thinks, "Geez," more times than I can count. There are so many repetitive tics. This trilogy would be ideal for a drinking game where the aim is to destroy someone's liver. Drink every time Anna thinks, "Geez." Drink every time Anna bites her lower lip, which, by the way, makes Christian want to ravish her. Drink every time the palm of Christian's hand twitches because he wants to spank Anna. Drink every time Anna thinks of Christian as enigmatic or mercurial. Drink every time Anna reflects on his extraordinary good looks. Drink every time Anna gets possessive of Christian, because every single human woman in the world eyes him lustily and becomes instantly tongue-tied. Drink every time the narrative continuity goes wildly off track. The game goes on and on. To hold all this nonsense together, Anna has 2 little friends. Her subconscious and her inner goddess, each personified. These ladies glare at Anna. They peer at her over their glasses. They twirl and swoon and sigh and grin and nod and otherwise reflect Anna's state of mind. For example, toward the end of the first book, Christian and Anna are about to get freaky, and there's this gift. My subconscious is frantically fanning herself, and my inner goddess is swaying and writhing to some primal carnal rhythm. She's so ready. Like Anna's inner goddess, I was so ready for these books, and that's an uncomfortable realization. That I can take pleasure in something so terrible. Like most people, I am a mass of contradictions. There are times when 50 Shades is amusing because the writing is terrible and fun, and then there are times when the book is terrible and infuriating in its irresponsibility. As Prince Charming, Christian fits the bill. He is ridiculously wealthy and handsome, but utterly lacking in imagination. E.L. James decides to complicate her Prince Charming. She gives the reader a little something more than the average dullard we generally have to yearn for in fairy tales. Christian has a tormented past. His mother is a crackhead, you see, which he casually discloses after a night of kinky passion. Anna is falling asleep next to him, and he says, "The woman who brought me into this world was a crack whore, Anastasia. Go to sleep." He seems to expect his confession will satisfy Anna's curiosity, but eventually he begins to disclose his dark past. Abuse by his mother's boyfriends, neglect, hunger. There's a lot of trauma there, and he wears it openly. As you might expect, Christian's past shapes his present in significant ways and provides a great deal of the incessant drama throughout the books. Forgive my indelicacy. But Christian Grey is a man who loves to run the fuck, and he's not afraid to show it. His need to be a dominant rises out of his need for control. In the second book, we learn Christian Grey enjoys dominating women, always beautiful brunettes, because they remind him of his mother. He's working on it with his therapist, Dr. Flynn, who makes the occasional appearance in ways that contradict the tenets of modern psychotherapy. There are any number of reasons why people engage in BDSM, but for James to so flagrantly pathologize the BDSM lifestyle as strictly a way for fucked up people to work out their emotional issues is beyond the pale. It is not an accurate portrayal of the community. It sends a wrong and unfair message about kink. The 50 Shades books have also opened the door for pundits, including Ellen DeGeneres, to treat the BDSM lifestyle with derision, mockery, and outright ignorance. Whips and chains are so very funny, or they are freaky and weird. For those who don't understand different expressions of sexuality, humor seems to be the easiest coping mechanism, unless, of course, you are critic Katie Roif, who concludes that the popularity of 50 Shades merely proves that independent women today secretly yearn to be dominated by men, but are afraid to admit their submissive desires. Roif takes her typical anti-feminist stance by supporting her argument with an odd range of vaguely related texts. Take Secretary and The Story of O and a few other cultural artifacts, et voila, irrefutable proof that women want to surrender sexually. At no time does Roif actually speak to submissive women about their desires. At no time does she try to understand the complexity of submissive sexual desire. Instead making a tenuous connection between a popular, highly fictional series of books and the state of modern female sexuality. Very little of the conversation about 50 Shades has included people who actually participate in the BDSM lifestyle and can speak intelligently and ethically on the subject, even though these people exist and are easy to find. Instead, people who know not of what they speak have made wild, lazy, insulting, or inaccurate conjectures about BDSM, all because a writer who is not terribly familiar with the lifestyle, she did a lot of online research, don't you know, thought kink would be a nice hook to hang her Twilight fan fiction on. My amusement with the 50 Shades series only goes so far. The books are essentially a detailed primer for how to successfully engage in a controlling, abusive relationship. The trilogy represents the darkest kind of fairy tale, one where controlling, obsessive, and borderline abusive tendencies are made to seem intensely desirable by offering the reader big heaping spoonfuls of sweet, sweet sex sugar to make the medicine go down. We can certainly credit the source material. Twilight offers similar instruction. Edward goes to absurd lengths to control Bella, all in the name of love. In 50 Shades, there are no limits to Christian's need to control Anna's life, her decisions, and their relationship. Even before they date, he conducts a background check. He tracks her movements via her cell phone in a way that is never quite explained, but that we're supposed to go along with because he is wealthy, and stalking people electronically is simply what wealthy people do. He tries to control when and how much Anna eats, the kind of alcohol she drinks, how she behaves around him, whom she allows in her life, how she travels, and we're supposed to believe this is all fine because he has issues. Because he loves her. In addition to the highly restrictive contract Christian wants Anna to sign, he also makes all his submissives sign a non-disclosure agreement, limiting what Anna is even legally allowed to share with her friends and loved ones about her life with Christian. Anna inexplicably signs this agreement because, as she tells Christian, she wouldn't have said anything anyway. She's a good girl. That's a common tactic of abusers, isolating their victims. But we're supposed to think the way Christian isolates Anna, in luxury, is romantic. A prison is still a prison, even when the sheets are 1,200 thread count. But the premise, in my weaker moments, is seductive enough to make that prison seem tolerable. In the first book, Anna decides to visit her mother in Georgia. Christian offers to travel with Anna, but she refuses because she, understandably, needs a little time and space to clear her head so she can decide if the BDSM lifestyle is one she can handle. Christian has to have some control over the situation, so he upgrades her to first class. We're supposed to think this is romantic, but mostly it's creepy, because he has gone to the trouble of figuring out her itinerary and changing it without consulting her. Then he simply flies down to Georgia to join Anna because he cannot bear to be apart from her. He's a man who knows what he wants. His needs are the only needs that matter. As the story proceeds, Christian is jealous when Anna is merely in the presence of another man. He gets angry or pouts when she won't pay enough attention to him. During a visit to his family's home, Anna defies Christian in some obscure way, so he drags her off to the boathouse to punish her. Her first instinct is to whisper, "Please don't hit me." This fear of being hit will come up more than once throughout the trilogy. He hires a security detail for her after one of his crazy, read heartbroken, former submissives has a mental breakdown after her boyfriend dies. But mostly it's an opportunity for him to control the boundaries of Anna's world in every possible way. When Anna gets a job, Christian buys the company where she works to protect her. In the third book, on their honeymoon, Anna decides to sunbathe topless at a nude beach. Christian, of course, does not appreciate his woman revealing herself to the world. She's not his submissive, but by God, she is his wife. He makes a scene. Later, they are making love in their hotel room, and he leaves hickeys all over her breasts. So not only can she no longer go topless, she cannot even wear a bikini top for the duration of their honeymoon. He literally marks his territory like a 16-year-old boy. Christian Grey uses sex as a weapon. He takes real pleasure in fucking her into submission when he cannot otherwise will her into submission. Nearly every sexual encounter between the young couple ends with Anna drowsy and unable to move, her limbs heavy and satiated with pleasure. In a consensual BDSM relationship, this dynamic would be fine, welcome even. But the overarching premise of the trilogy is that Anna doesn't want a BDSM relationship. At least, not the kind Christian wants. She certainly enjoys their kinky sexual relationship, but she consistently clarifies her overall disinterest in serving as Christian's submissive. Their relationship is beyond refractory. Anna is, like Bella in Twilight, the vanquished, the undead, and Christian Grey is the proud vanquisher. After each instance of abusive, controlling behavior, Anna gets righteously indignant, but never for long. Time and again, she chooses to sacrifice what she really wants for the opportunity to be loved by her half-assed Prince Charming. We're supposed to believe Anna is independent because she defies Christian by having very reasonable expectations and boundaries. He willfully ignores these boundaries, though, and she allows him to. She forgives all his trespasses. The trilogy also relies heavily on the trope of the imperiled woman. In each book, Anna faces some kind of danger, either innocuous or quite serious, that reminds us she is a woman, and therefore in need of rescue by her Prince Charming. After each crisis, Christian clutches Anna desperately and says he doesn't know what he would do if anything happened to her. If you look up the word codependent in the dictionary, this couple's picture will be featured prominently. I'm all for reading for pleasure. I'm a fan of dirty books and kink. I am down with female submission. By the end of 50 Shades Freed, however, where Anna acknowledges that Christian is as controlling as ever, even though they have found a happily ever after, his pattern of abusive, petty, and at times childish behavior is exhausting and far too familiar. This Prince Charming has lost all his charm. When considering the overwhelming popularity of this trilogy, we cannot simply dismiss the flaws because the books are fun and the sex is hot. The damaging tone has too broad a reach. That tone reinforces pervasive cultural messages women are already swallowing about what they should tolerate in romantic relationships, about what they should tolerate to be loved by their Prince Charming. 50 Shades is a fairy tale. There's a man and a woman, and an obstacle that eventually they are able to overcome. There is a happily ever after, but the price exacted is terribly high. It is frightening to consider how many women might be willing to pay that price. Race and entertainment. The solace of preparing fried foods and other quaint remembrances from 1960s Mississippi. Thoughts on the help. When my brothers and I have a particularly frustrating day with white people, we'll call one another and say, "Today is a Rosewood day." Nothing more needs to be said. Rosewood is set in 1923. And tells the story of Rosewood, a deeply segregated, primarily black town in Florida. A married white woman in nearby Sumner is beaten by her lover. With no other way to explain the marks on her body to her husband, She cries rape, and when the townsmen ask her who has done this terrible thing, the white woman predictably shrieks, "It was a nigger." The white men proceed to lose their minds, surrender to a mob mentality, and